Philip Morgan.
Liston.io. How you doing, my man?
Tis I. I'm good, my friend. Welcome to Offline once again.
Once again.
Online, offline. Is it ironic that we call this offline, but we record it online?
I suppose. I guess we didn't really think the show name through sufficiently.
I still like it. I think it's solid.
It's got a ring to it. I'm with it. Yeah, let's keep it. We're not going to change it to the Tough Love podcast.
Okay.
Well, we're not going to change it to the Liston Tries to Sell Philip on Paid Acquisition podcast. So,
or Liston Tries to Sell Philip on LinkedIn Video podcast. That phase has passed.
It has. It's not the two confidence buddies help each other out podcast.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess we're sticking with offline. The podcast where two online consultants talk offline.
Yes. It's our private conversation, public. Well, not quite. It's close to that. So I want to promote a new thing that I just made, and it's called 5 email follow-up templates to help consultants follow up without being annoying. So one problem that I hear a lot of people have is they don't know how to keep talking to people. They don't know how to follow up effectively. They don't know how to be different. They don't know how to be interesting. And they start sending emails that are like, hey, did you get my last email? Did you get my last email? So I have a short ebook for you. It's available on my website, liston.io, liston.io. You can go grab it right now.
Is it free?
Indeed, it is free, Philip.
Can you give me a flavor of one of the email templates? Just a taste.
Sure. There are lots of them, but one of my favorites is I just came up with a new idea for you.
Oh.
So essentially it would go like you email your client and it's either been a while or maybe they're in the middle of their decision phase of the sale. And you say, hey, I just came up with a new idea. Would you like to hear it? And you're prompting them to re-engage in conversation. And then you look like someone who has all these great ideas and you're doing it. You're delivering a little extra value that took you maybe 10 minutes prior to them signing the contract, which is great timing. So that is one of the templates that you can use.
Nice. Okay. I'm dripping with anticipation. I'm going to go download this myself. Cool. Well, I guess I'll promote specialization school. That's the only thing I can think of to promote right now. The next batch of workshops comes up in October. I haven't sent out payment links yet, but it looks like 2 out of 7 seats in one of the workshops are spoken for. You know, if the idea of getting a process plus some custom help from me in a group setting on making the decision about how to specialize, if that idea is interesting, you might check out specializationschool.com. And from there, you can take a next step of contacting me and setting up a call to make sure it's a good fit.
Love that.
Me too.
Yeah, you would.
I would.
All right. So, Philip, today, you and I have both built businesses where it's just us, which is kind of not true. Not for me anyway. And maybe that's another discussion for another time. The myth of the solo business.
Yeah.
But essentially, like, I don't have any employees. You don't have any employees. And we've been able to start to scale our impact through not working 120 hours a week, but by packaging and scaling our ideas and expertise. So this was your topic. I guess first, why don't we take a second to discuss what does it mean to have scalable impact? I have a pretty clear idea in my head, but I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Recently, a couple people who are published authors approached me about being on my other podcast, the Consulting Pipeline podcast. And they did so through their booking agencies. And in the course of those conversations, so one guy was the author of this book, Built to Sell. And the other guy is the co-founder and current CEO of FreshBooks. So these are people who have their fingers in a lot of entrepreneurial type of pies. And when I ask them about their sort of mental models of entrepreneurship, I get a pretty standard sort of thing back, which is you can be a freelancer that's not a purely entrepreneurial model, but that's a model for working for yourself. That's a model for having a business, is you're essentially a freelancer. You get this from Seth Godin as well, actually.
Yes. He says if you don't have employees, you're a freelancer, I think.
Right. You know, he has these clever ways of saying it. But yeah, basically, he says, if you're not able to leverage other people's time in your business to make money, then you're a freelancer.
Right. You're not an entrepreneur.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a, I find, a pretty standard kind of binary division between freelancers and entrepreneurs. That's a pretty common model, is entrepreneurs are going to build a system that makes use of other human beings who are functioning as employees or contractors or whatever. And that system is going to scale by adding people or something basically along those lines. And by definition, the freelancer is working alone by themselves, or maybe in collaboration with other people, but their company has one person and it's them. And so their company is limited by what they can charge for their time or what they can charge for the value that they create. But something about that model seems to me like it's missing something, because what I've seen in my own life is I actually make more money working fewer hours in 2018 than I did in 2017 or 2016. So I don't see in my own business and life this one-to-one relationship between how much I work and how much money I make. And it's not just because I've like increased an hourly rate. It is because I have found vehicles for making money that are the subject of what we want to talk about today. And to me, these things are somewhat entrepreneurial. They occupy this kind of middle ground between the solo lone wolf freelancer on the one end and the system powered by people on the other hand. And so I thought we should talk about some ideas for that middle ground where you have this revenue is scalable, but also your ability to make things better in the world, which is how I think of impact. That's also scalable, and it's not intrinsically linked to how many hours I work. So that's sort of where I was coming from when I threw this idea out, is I feel like this, the common model is lacking something, and the thing it's lacking is totally powered by the internet and by digital tools. And maybe that's why that model doesn't have a third category in the middle like I have in my head, is because it's out of date. Anyway, enough of a monologue. What are you thinking when you think about scalable impact?
I think the main way that I would think about scaling my impact is moving beyond the amount of service I could provide at a one-to-one level. So most consulting service companies, it's really about one person working with one other person.
Sure. Or one client. Yeah.
Yeah, one client, right? But it's essentially one-to-one work. And so as soon as we can start moving to a one-to-many model, that starts to look like scaling, because now I can essentially charge my clients a little less and make more per unit of time still,
right,
for packaging my expertise in a particular way. And we're going to get to that, but I want to throw a wrench in this, Philip.
Uh-oh.
I think I do disagree with you slightly.
Okay.
So I agree with you. Like, I've been able to increase my revenue this year, partially as a result of scaling, but mainly through just having a different business model. Like, I would say you're farther ahead in the scaling race than I am.
Okay.
But I'll be catching up. So watch your ass, buddy.
Oh, you're going to be passing me in a few months. I'm sure of that.
Well, I don't know about that. But because I think of a business like, let's think about Seth Godin, marketing seminar. So for those of you who don't know, marketing seminar is a series of videos. And then I think there's also like a group kind of accountability section, but Seth doesn't show up to that. You don't get to meet Seth if you take marketing school. So he recorded videos one time. It's probably some emails that go with it. And then there's like a community element that they set up for you.
Right.
Now he could run that on his own if he wanted to, but I'm guessing, and I don't know the inner workings of his business, but let me just go out on a limb and say he's not doing that. He has people on his team doing the sales for him. He has people on his team making sure that the groups run well, doing the onboarding, answering support tickets.
Yep.
And so I do think if you want to achieve true scale, which is maybe not, I can take on infinite people, but I could take on a factor of say 10 or 20 more people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually think it's possible to do that on your own. However, that doesn't change the idea that if you package your ideas and your expertise, you can get much more scalability and mileage out of it. But what I do think is if you have really ambitious goals for the number of people you want to reach, and like I want to reach 10 million people, I really don't believe that I can do that on my own.
Right. And that brings up an interesting question to take the marketing seminar as a specific example, which I've not been through it. I think I signed up and there was like a week, they called it an open house, I think.
I find it very difficult to figure out how to become a part of that thing. I've actually emailed and said, can you send me a payment link? I'd like to do it. And I've heard nothing.
Interesting. I guess he doesn't have enough people helping him out on the email front.
Maybe it is just that.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of back to our previous episode of this podcast. It's an open cart, closed cart model for a thing. It's like, I don't know, every 2-3 months, he's opening up registrations and closing them at, I don't know, the end of the month or some time period. So maybe that's why you haven't, or maybe he's just got so many balls in the air that he's dropping a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you're right that there's no way he could do that without the help of other people. I mean, I've seen enough of it from that open house to know that he's sort of showing up as the star of the show for a Q&A session, I don't know, once a week or once a month or something like that, but that's it. He recorded the videos. Who knows how much help he had designing the curriculum. I imagine he was very heavily involved, but he kind of built a thing that now relies on the labor and the involvement of other people for it to work. So you're right. I think there's this point at which you're absolutely right that there's some kind of ceiling on any given thing scaling with just one person behind it. But that ceiling can be huge. It can be very high. And something like a breakthrough bestseller book, almost by definition, is going to have other people involved, but they're not involved in an ongoing basis.
Right. And I think the only thing I'm saying is we live in a world with limits.
Yeah.
Like I'm not going out on a limb here, but even with your book, the way most authors will make money is not by selling the book. It's by going on a speaking tour after they publish the book.
Right.
Like Simon Sinek, I'm guessing most of his revenue comes from corporate consulting and going out and being a keynote speaker.
Pretty safe guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when I say most, like probably 80% or more.
Yeah. Unless he self-published, that's almost certainly true.
Well, and then there's a chance you never would have heard of the book, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the trade-off usually.
Yeah. Which is not a small trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we've set the stage. So let's go over some models because I think some people may be wondering, okay, if I wanted to scale my impact, what are some ways I could do that? And I think we have 7 or 8 different options here.
Yeah.
And the first on the list is what you and I both did first to scale our impact, which is workshops.
Not technically first for me, but I'm with you.
Oh, you did your book, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, on the timeline, the book came first, but
okay,
that's a detail, minor detail. Anyway, yeah, workshops. So there's a group component to the workshop. I mean, I guess you could do a workshop with one person in it, but if it's working the way it's designed, it's a group thing, right? And I'm trying to remember, I'm not sure that I ever intentionally said, I'm going to do group things because I really like how the money works on that. But I have ended up really liking how the money works on group things. So specialization school is a series of workshops, but before that, there was and still is something I call the Position Accelerator Program, which is, let's call it group coaching or group mentoring. Same thing. Once I started to see the two things about that, the stability of the revenue month to month and the way that it made such great use of my time, I was in love, Liston, with this idea of going to get a group of people together. Everybody pays basically the same amount and they all experience the same thing, but the profitability is significant because it's me just showing up for this entire group of people at the same time. So I think it scales both impact and revenue, not infinitely, as you pointed out, there are limits, but I like it a lot better than, you know, I'll write some web copy for you. I feel like I would have to charge so much for the web copy that I would really start to question the value.
Right.
Meaning I would have to charge so much for it, for that to be as profitable an activity as doing this group thing, this workshop.
Yep.
It really makes that one-to-one service delivery look pretty bad from a profitability perspective when you start to experience this kind of the dynamics of a group of people paying you money to do a thing that they're all going to do together. Maybe all that stuff is obvious. I don't know. But to me, workshops are not that huge of a leap from doing one-to-one service delivery. I don't know. They might be one of the easiest things to start with because if someone is paying you to do something, I think they're acknowledging that you know how to do something they don't know how to do. They might just be paying you to do something they don't have time to. We paid some guys today to hang some pictures in our house because I didn't want to do it. And I didn't want to get that high on a ladder, and they had a taller ladder. So they had some tools that I didn't have, and they had some willingness to be 15 feet off the ground that I didn't have.
Yeah.
But the know-how, I know how to do it just as well as they do. I just didn't want to. So yeah, there's cases like that. But what I'm saying is, if someone's paying you to do something, you already have proof that you know how to do a thing. So I don't think it's that big of a step to maybe setting up a workshop and teaching people to do it or helping them do it in a group setting.
Right. Yeah. And I think the other thing that I would recommend on workshops, and one thing that I've found very helpful about doing a workshop, is built into the structure of it is one-to-many interaction, right? So you, the expert, the service provider, will show up, give feedback, and you get such rich information about how people are experiencing the workshop as you created it, what you can change or tweak along the way, what other products they might want to see from you. Like, there's just this fantastic feedback mechanism built into it, which again, I know is a little bit selfish, but from the perspective of getting started with your first kind of package version, if you're going to try to at least dip your toe into how do I start to scale my impact, I think workshops are fantastic because in real time, you're able to adjust. And I've seen this in mine. So I'm right now still doing it at the time of this recording. I'm in the process of doing it. I've produced 6 out of 8 modules. By the time you're hearing this, dear listener, the course is done and it went excellent and I got 100% 5-star reviews. But as I've been going through it, I'd say starting in module 2 even, I listened to the feedback and heard from people what was working, what wasn't, how they perceived it, things I could emphasize. I even adjusted the structure of the course given the feedback I got in the first week or two.
Yeah.
And so I even changed how much time I was spending on one topic versus another. So I find that really, really valuable. And that's a great way to start. Also, because it's directly relevant to people who may have wanted to buy from you in the past, and it gives them a lower entry point in order to work with you in a very similar way. It's not the same, but it's similar. So you probably have a built-in market for it.
I think there's lots of ways maybe to define a workshop, but an easy one is it's 30% teaching and 70% people in the workshop doing something that basically is hands-on learning. So just by way of definition, you know, a workshop would typically have some kind of goal, like you're going to come out of this and you're going to have built something. It may be just a sort of practice version of something that you want to build. Like if you think about like a pottery making workshop, when you come out of this, you will have made a tea kettle out of clay and you'll have fired and glazed it. Well, that would be the objective, is like, okay, I know if I do this workshop and I show up and I do the work, I'm going to walk out of there with a thing that I've built. I think that's a useful way to differentiate a workshop from just straight up training. And also, hopefully, for the folks listening, it helps lower the stakes for you if you are considering doing something like this, because it's less of a performance. Like when you're doing training, it can feel like a performance. It can feel like you are lecturing to a group of people, because a lot of times you will be. Yeah.
It is.
Whereas with a workshop, it's more like little pieces of something that looks like training surrounded by bigger pieces of, I want you to go build this thing, and I'm here if you need help with that, or I'm here to give you feedback as you do it. But this time is for you to build something. And so I really do believe it lowers the stakes. I think it's a lower stakes place to start.
Yep.
Do you agree with that? You've done both, so you should know.
I do agree with that. I think it's lower stakes. And actually, I think this is a good transition into kind of the next thing that you could do, which is a course. Now, this is the sexiest of all sexy ideas for online, anybody doing business online like us. What do you agree with that?
I'm swooning. I'm getting hot and sweaty just thinking about it as we talk about it.
I knew you would. So just calm down there, buddy. So obviously the attraction of courses, it's something that I can sell for a lot of money, usually in the multiple hundreds of dollars to even thousands of dollars, for something that I package once and then sell over and over and over again. So the difference between a course and a workshop being, there's not usually an expectation that you, Philip, or I, Liston, would show up and help people through the material. It's totally DIY, typically.
Right.
And so that's really, really sexy. I think, though, if you started with the workshop, again, back to this idea of feedback, you would have a much better chance of developing a course that's awesome. Because most people develop crappy courses and then leave a wake of people who are pissed off.
Yeah, I'd say the numbers surely would bear that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the interactivity of a workshop or a course delivered live, at least the first few times, does help prevent that. I think there's also another difference that particularly shows up with folks like us who maybe are not full-time experts in course creation or full-time experts in training. And what happens is we can let ourselves off the hook. And I feel like I've done this to a certain extent. I'm not proud of it. I was doing the best I could at the time. But there's something about the idea of a course, which is the change is going to happen in somebody's mind. They're going to learn something, they're going to acquire information, or they're going to understand a new way of seeing things. But if that's what you're thinking is going to come out of this experience, is someone is going to have some new information in their mind, then you're going to be tempted to approach the course in a way that's likely to lead to failure. Because you'll basically say, well, my job is to pump out as much information under the topic of this course as I possibly can. Well, that makes for a really crappy course if it's just an information dump. There are much better formats for an information dump. There's no need to charge hundreds of dollars for an information dump. So I guess I feel compelled to add that. Maybe that's just my own personal experience, is that I think courses are harder. And it's because you think that what you're doing is easy, but what you're doing is not easy at all.
Yeah, I agree. It's not easy. And I also think there's the potential to hurt your brand in the long run. I was just looking up a popular internet marketer site, and he lists his revenue, so maybe you could figure out who it is. I won't name names. But at one point, it looked like chargebacks were about 10% of his revenue.
Wow.
Wow, that's really bad. 1 out of 10 people are so upset that they act on the money back guarantee. To me, that's a sign that there's something disastrously wrong with your business.
Is that refund requests or actual chargebacks where the person disputes the charge with their credit card company?
Oh, I'm sorry. Like total refunds that he gave.
Which is still bad.
It's horrible.
I actually have another example. Again, I won't name names, but I did some work briefly with a client, and I will name the other name. He was in talks with, I think it was Agora Publishing, which is one of these companies that publishes tons of information products, both digital and print. I think Agora is like a $100 million company. Like, it's a big-ass publishing company.
Okay.
And they do all sorts of things, like these newsletters that you pay $100 a month for with investment advice.
Sure.
There's like, I'm not doing it because I got to work out later today and I want to save my energy, but there's air quotes around everything I'm saying in this investment advice newsletters. Anyway, this guy said that their chargeback rate was closer to 10%, meaning people disputing the charges with their credit card company.
Yeah.
Not just the refund rate, the chargeback rate. I think I have heard at least one credible example of an actual 10% chargeback rate, and I was horrified.
And when he said it, how much shame was in his voice?
Well, he was not as much as I would expect, to be honest. That's all I'm going to say. I would have been mortified if I learned that. But then also, I think it was because neither of us was surprised. It was sort of like, holy shit, that is so many unhappy people. And then you think for a second about the basic business model and you're like, yeah, I guess it kind of makes sense. They use a lot of really high pressure sales tactics and overpromising sales letters. And when you think about that, you're kind of not surprised. Anyway, this could be quite a rabbit hole.
Yeah, this could be a rabbit hole. And I'm always curious, does it make economic sense to do that? So in other words, do you get more sales than chargebacks and refund requests? My guess is yes, that it does make economic sense. And then the other question I would have is, what is the reputation effect that that has on your business to create so many people who are pissed off about their experience with you?
Yeah.
So that's another topic for another time. So next up on our list is an obvious one. It's where you started, and that is writing a book or writing multiple books. And some people's business model is writing books. So what was your experience with writing a book, and would you recommend it?
I would, obviously, pending the details of someone's situation. It may not be right for everybody, but I would generally recommend it. I did not know we were going to be talking about this today, but I did the numbers for the positioning manual. Lifetime numbers here, about 1,800 sales. Some of those sales were $0 sales, but about that in terms of how many people have got the book in their hands. And lifetime revenue is $70,000, give or take.
Wow.
Some.
Okay. Over what time period?
About 3 years. I'd have to look to be sure. I think this December or the next January, I think it'll be the 3-year mark. I mean, just to put this in context, like those numbers, I think to me are wonderful. This was my freshman effort at writing a book. This was something that I, as I've mentioned before on this podcast, was just kind of an experiment. It wasn't like a big serious project that I was undertaking. And I think those results are wonderful. And by the way, that revenue does not count, because it would be hard to attribute, and I don't really have the data anyway, but it does not count follow-on, like, hey, let me hire you to help me with the ideas in this book. Doesn't count that revenue at all.
Well, and there's no way to even know, could you attribute 100% of that to the book either? But right. Yep. Certainly it's created more clients for you as a result of having that book.
For sure. There's no doubt in my mind about that. So anyway, I mean, those are the numbers, and it's scalable impact because, I mean, there's a couple ways to think about it. There's the sort of generous take on it, which is how many people's lives have I made better because of this book? Well, maybe as many as 1,800, probably fewer, because I know there's plenty of people who bought the book, downloaded it and said mission accomplished and never got beyond the first few pages. They said, oh, I'll come back to this later when I have more time. This looks interesting or whatever, right? Maybe not 1,800 people, but I don't know, maybe 1,000 people have been positively impacted by this book. I don't know if I'll ever work with that many people in my career, maybe, but kind of depends on my business model and how I do things. But still, that's a significant number. That's one way to look at it, right? How many people have been positively impacted by this thing? And then the other way to look at it is how much business development was that for me where I actually got paid $50 or $99 or whatever someone paid for the book. They paid me to become a lead and then they became a client later.
Right.
I mean, most of us, I think rightly think of business development as overhead, meaning it's a cost that we have to bear to get the business that we get. And there's low cost ways to do it and high cost ways to do it and everything in between. But there is a cost to it, at least in terms of time. And this is different. This is like business development where I get paid coming and going. How amazing is that? So there's that way to look at the scalable impact of this. And then there's this sort of long game way to look at it as, holy crap, I'm a published author. I don't think I would self-apply the term best-selling because I don't know where that number is for self-published books and there's no external third party to validate it. So,
right. It's not like being a New York Times bestseller.
It's not. And I've heard other people describe their self-published books as best-selling. And I'm always like, tell me more because I think you might be using a different criteria for that than I would. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. What I'm saying is in the long game, this has changed my career, I guess is what I'm trying to say. For the better, absolutely. It's made it possible to move into advisory work. It's made all these things possible. And it's shown me that I can do this, which means I can do it again. Maybe the second one would not be as successful. Maybe it would be far more successful. I don't know. But it's changed me. That's part of the impact as well.
Yeah.
So that's in a nutshell my experience with the book. Just like I can't find anything negative about it. I don't have anything bad to say about the whole thing. It was so worth it.
Well, I think the only thing that would be negative is maybe the opportunity cost because it does take a long time to put it together. If you don't know how to publish it on your own and sell it on your own, there's going to be a fairly stiff learning curve there.
Mm-hmm.
So one advantage you had obviously was you already understood internet marketing. You could put together email automation and sell it automatically to people. And that, yeah, I'm guessing is where most of your sales have come from. But I would agree with you. I'd say it's mostly positive and definitely on the list of things for me to do in the near future.
Yeah, I recently, meaning yesterday, recorded a conversation with Josh Duty, who is the author of Fearless Salary Negotiation. And his story is quite similar in that he wrote this book. With him, it was more intentional. The writing of the book was more intentional. But what it did was created a platform atop which he sells coaching services. And that's the lion's share. I mean, he says this in his interview, that's the lion's share of his revenue. You can look at it as a scalable business development tool. You can look at it as scalable revenue, as sort of quote unquote passive income, although it's not totally passive. And you can look at it as, you know, a way to kind of as a branding tool, I suppose. I mean, those are at least three ways to look at a sort of book project. It can be a business card, or it can be a revenue source, or it could be both. What do you think the perception is, Liston? If you told people, I have a self-published book that could pay for a BMW 5 Series car in cash with the revenue that it's produced, would people be blown away or would they be like, oh, okay? Would they be kind of not impressed?
Well, I think it's simpler than that. I think if you just say, I have a book that I wrote, I think that's sufficient for most people to be impressed. I find it interesting that even now, with all of the self-publishing tools available, and the fact that I could publish a book on Amazon that was exactly one page and say I'm a published author, even right, still, people are impressed when you tell them I'm a published author.
Right.
So I do think that there's a reputational element to it. Even if you throw out the revenue idea, there's a big reputational element of it, although just going for the reputation doesn't exactly help you scale your impact. But I think that that's one of the major benefits that comes from it.
Yeah. It's not that you can just write any crappy thing and that's good enough, but I wonder if the bar is higher than people think it is. That's really what I was getting at is people are impressed. Oh, you published a book. Because there's this kind of halo effect of what it used to take to publish a book.
Yeah.
The mechanics of doing it now are vastly easier. You still have to produce something that produces a positive ROI on the time it takes to read it. But even that might be a lower bar than people think. That might be easier than people think. So this is me just sort of ham-fistedly trying to encourage people to consider it. It might be easier than you think to do.
Yeah. Just to prove your point, there's a great article on Observer.com called Behind the Scam, What Does It Take to Be a Best-Selling Author? $3 in 5 minutes. And this guy wrote, it shows text messages that he sent his friends, attempt to get the best-selling tag next to the book on Amazon. And here's a great text message. He says, hey, what's up, to his friend Aaron. Aaron says, at dinner, what's up? And the author says, need you to buy my book written by my foot, featuring only a photo of my foot. Aaron replies, done. So you too could be a best-selling author.
That is impact, I guess. Not the kind I was thinking of.
That's not scaling your impact, but you can cheat to have a best-selling book. Okay. So moving on, if I'm thinking about how to apply your consulting the best, one of the things that we have on this list is speaking. I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to scale the same impact that you're giving in your consulting. I think it's a way that you can scale your revenue and scale your reach, but I think it's a different thing unto itself. So I don't want to spend too much time on that. But the next thing we have is training.
Okay.
So you and I both know people, I think we've both had clients who do some level of training. And I think what training implies is often you are giving people almost like a condensed lecture series, right? 1 or 2 days, heads down, you're going to focus on this topic. I'm going to tell you everything you need to know about it. And then good luck, and you're done, more or less. That's how most training programs work, where they're a very short time period and very focused on a particular outcome and topic.
Yeah, I think if you take that idea of workshop being 30% concept, 70% application, and just flip it, that's pretty close to what a lot of training is. Real heavy on the concepts and the facts and information, and relatively light on the application thereof. The idea is, okay, you're going to be exposed to this information, and then you're going to go apply it on your own, on your job, or in your work, which is actually pretty close to how a book works. It's just the same kind of ratio in a book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yes. Yes to what you said.
So I think training is a good option, just like workshops are a good option if you really like sort of being in charge in a group environment. And I think training in particular, there is such thing as online training, but I think most companies expect it to happen in person. So if you're not comfortable in that environment, I think training will be a real challenge for you.
Yeah, that likely entails travel and logistics. You know, you get help with that. If your clients or corporations are used to buying training, they probably have some infrastructure in place to kind of facilitate that. So you're not necessarily having to rent a venue and make sure all the technology is there. They might have a training facility at their offices.
Right.
But yeah, what's interesting to me about this in light of our discussion here is it's probably not the easiest starting point, but it's probably easier than you think.
I agree.
I keep saying that, and I'm like, am I being irresponsible here? But it gets back to this idea that we've discussed before, that I think more of us have to challenge ourselves to kind of lean out over our skis and do things that we're not necessarily uncomfortable with. That may not be training, but training, I think for a lot of people, will feel like a real risk because they'll have this idea that they need to know everything there is to know about the topic. And that's not true at all.
Yep.
You're a resource, okay, as the instructor, and you can go find that information in a just-in-time basis. You don't have to know everything. In fact, if you try to pretend like you know everything, people will see right through that. They'll smell that a mile away. They won't appreciate it. And I know this firsthand because I have a background in adult training. I was an IT, you know, technical trainer, Microsoft certified system engineer, Microsoft certified trainer in the 90s. So I have background with this, and I tried that exactly once. I tried to pretend that I knew something that I didn't. I immediately ascertained that that was never going to work. So you just say, I don't know. Anyway, getting into the weeds, but training is scalable in the same way because it's a group thing. You get paid per seat, or sometimes it's just a per class thing. But a lot of times the rates are pretty darn nice. You and I are both in a Slack room where there's a couple folks who do training, and we get to see in text form their joy and enthusiasm when their training rate exceeds their consulting rate. it happens. I can't count on one hand the number of times I've seen that happen firsthand, where someone's like, okay, I could make $5,000 a week consulting, and I just landed a week worth of training at 7 or 10. And it's like, I can feel just emanating from them this like, whoa, oh my God, this is so cool. And it is so cool.
Yeah. And to your point about it being not as hard as you think it may be, I think with all of these things that we're suggesting today, the first time is always the hardest, right? That first time you try to sell it and the first time you try to do it, it's never going to be more difficult than that. So if it's worth the experiment, I would say definitely go for it.
And don't be a dum-dum and have your first time be the most difficult possible version of that. Like, don't try to compete at an Olympic level when you're a high school track runner. It's like, don't go for those big leaps, but also don't let that prevent you from starting as well.
I love that's your soundbite today. Philip's advice is don't be a dum-dum.
I like that too.
That's funny. Okay, so next on the list is licensing. And I would say this is a little bit more of an advanced thing, but I'll give an example of what this might look like. So Philip, you have a proprietary process for determining a company's positioning or an individual's positioning, right?
It's proprietary, but not secret, because I talk about it all the time. But it is proprietary in that I invented it. I don't know anybody else who has a similar process. It's not that complicated, but yeah, we could call it proprietary.
Let's call it proprietary. Or you just have a way of doing things that works for you and has been proven to work for some other clients.
Yep.
And so if you wanted, you could package that up, let's say, to marketing agencies who want to help their clients with positioning.
Yeah.
And you could license the Philip Morgan way of doing it to those other companies. Now, this is a really common business model for consultants. If you've heard of The E-Myth by Michael Gerber, then you know of a book by a guy who ran a consulting company that helped small businesses build their businesses. And ultimately now one of his main sources of revenue is through licensing to E-Myth certified coaches.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, similarly, Philip, you could pursue a licensing model. I'm really attracted to this model. I think it's a really good one, but I also think you need to hit some level of market scale and awareness before this starts to make sense.
Yeah, this of all the ones that we've mentioned on our list thus far, this one strikes me as the least likely to be accessible to, let's just call it, say, a beginner. And in some ways, I'm not a beginner, but in other ways, I am. Like, my business has not been around for 20 years.
Well, I'd also say with a licensing model, I think a lot of companies will take on debt or give up some equity for a cash infusion because of the expense of acquiring licensees.
Right, which is kind of a non-starter for me. So, but yeah, it's there are things that can be licensed. David Baker's talked about this publicly, so he has some numbers that come from like 20 years of work with marketing agencies, right? Numbers that are like, what does the typical marketing agency pay their CEO as a percentage of revenue? Like stuff like that, just to give people a sense. And actually, I've never looked at this data, so I don't know. David and I are acquainted, but we're not that close. So my point is, he has data that's useful in other contexts. Like, again, he's talked about this publicly in his writing, so I can share that he licenses that data to some, at least one SaaS company that is some kind of like financial dashboard type software product. And so they're using his numbers to help their the users of their software understand their financial health as a business.
Oh, interesting.
That's a licensing arrangement. That's an example of you're focused, so you're doing the same thing for a long enough period of time to accumulate enough useful data that can then be packaged and sold as a licensing arrangement to someone else who benefits from that.
Yep.
I don't have a ton of examples of this because it's not, to be honest, super common, but there's no reason it's not accessible to people like us who run businesses like ours, not on day one, but 5-10 years into it with the right kind of work, I think you could definitely get there.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that this is definitely the longer play. Like, we wouldn't start with licensing because of all the groundwork that needs to be done ahead of time.
Right.
Now, the last one on the list is products. So some people may consider a course a product, but let's consider a course, and a product pretty much anything else. And so one example of a product that I just bought that came from someone who was selling information online was Michael Hyatt's Full Focus Planner. And it's a daily planning book, a bound book that I think was like $30. I mean, it wasn't crazy expensive.
Seth Godin released something very similar, some kind of day planner with some kind of secret sauce baked into it.
Right. And like with Michael's, you go on and he goes, oh, you'll notice in my planner, there are several concepts that are drawn from my course, blah, blah, blah. And so he's pitching his course essentially indirectly through it, but it's very well done. It's totally affordable and it can reach more people. And our mutual friend, Carl Sakis, also has, actually, I guess they're books, but he sort of treats them as products where he'll mail you his books. I don't know if he's mailed you his books, but
yeah,
I got a shipment of his books, which felt, something about them being tangible felt very different than just selling a book online.
Yeah. And I know you got to go in a minute here, but there are other products too, like software,
yes,
like templates that you could sell. I'm thinking, of course, primarily of digital products. There's a lot of just really interesting opportunities there that, again, I think fit this scalable impact model. Maybe the impact is more about revenue to you than it is about improving a client's condition, but the scalability piece can be there with products, which can be really nice. They can be so simple. They don't have to be extensive and huge and complicated.
Yep. Totally agree. Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of wrestling with that right now. Should I have a product that could be a precursor, maybe a couple precursors to a course and stepwise into a workshop, stepping into some sort of longer term coaching arrangement.
Yeah, some kind of, I mean, your 5 email templates thing is a product that has a $0 price tag.
Right. Well, and then I could obviously create, if you like the 5, get the 55.
Right. Yeah.
$50 or $100.
Which is a sort of middle ground between a book and a product, but a product is, I think, the meta category. Book is a subset of it.
Yep.
But yeah, we're running out of time here, but I hope that folks are encouraged as a result of this to think about ways that they can benefit clients and produce money without, I mean, it might take a ton of time up front, but without the ongoing time that client work involves.
Agreed. Yep. I think there's a long list here and we'll include those in the show notes. And thanks for listening. Philip, you have yourself a good day, my friend.
You too, buddy. Bye for now.
Bye.